Welcome, this is William Evans, and you're listening to Shifting Gears. Our guest today is Dr. Will Bledsoe, a new member of the Carbondale community. Welcome to Carbondale.
Well, thank you.
Tell us what you're doing.
Right now I'm sitting in a chair being interviewed by you. No, I'm kidding. Sorry. What I'm doing, I am trying to put the restorative process into people's hands so that they can use it to restore relationships that have been damaged by violation.
Restorative seems to be a hot word in this time.
Well, restoration is a sexy term. I mean, when you say the word, it, you know, what is it? What do you feel? It's like, restoration. And restoration is a term that embodies a certain amount of optimism because it implies that something or some relationship or some condition can be restored. And so the term restoration promises a return to an ideal or an original or an intended condition.
People seem to be claiming to be restoring justice, rivers, schools, and probably more systems than I even know about.
Yeah, I think, you know, it comes out of restorative justice. I mean, restorative justice started arguably in the late 1980s and then grew into restorative justice in the 1990s, late part of the 90s, and then sort of morphed into restorative school discipline that started in the early 2000s. But the roots of restorative justice, in other words, this approach to human violation, scholars say existed thousands of years before Christ, when human beings were, you know, when we were family clan units and living in tribal communities. And some people claim that the restorative approach to human misconduct and violation is our species' original justice instinct. And the reason they say that is because when you think about it from a tribal perspective, when the survival of the tribe or the clan depended upon the contribution of each and every member, and when the survival depended upon harmonious relationships between its members, then the goal of any resolution or reconciliation or justice process would be to return those conflicted parties back into a functioning, contributing relationship, interdependence.
So that seems to me like that explains some of the high visibility of this word restorative. Mm-hmm. It's got an appeal because there's a deep hunger for that.
There is. I mean, who doesn't want to be restored? You know, and I personally think it's part of our DNA. I mean, you know, when you think about the body's innate capacity for healing, it is biologically predisposed to continuously restore itself.
I'm interested in some of your experience. Tell us about the judge in Boulder who asked you to put a program together to deal with University of Colorado students who lived off campus.
Right. So in 2004, I was facilitating conferences for the Longmont Community Justice Partnership, and restorative justice program is always viewed as a diversion from conventional, you know, prosecution, and the requirement is that the offender admit that they had committed the offense and be willing on a certain level to take responsibility for how it harmed other people. And so restorative justice, people come together in a circle, the offender, the victims, family members, community members, and two facilitators, and talk about what happened and you know, who was impacted and how they were impacted, and then put forth an agreement for the offender to reparative agreement for the offender to repair the damage that they've caused. And so I was facilitating conferences for the Longmont program while I was working on the doctorate at CU. And CU had a fledgling pilot program that they were trying to build to handle infractions of student code of conduct. And the program was in danger of being disbanded because they were only doing about 7 to 12 cases a year, and those cases were mainly on-campus infractions of the student code of conduct, so, you know, things happening in the dorm. But the municipal court judge, Linda Cook, wanted the university to begin to take more responsibility for the violations of conduct that were happening off-campus by CU students. And I think the research I did around 2004, 2006, there were approximately 1,400 violations of conduct codes and, you know, city ordinances that CU students were committing. And so the judge wanted the university to take more responsibility for it. And so she found out that I was at the university and still doing cases for Longmont. But she said, why can't the restorative justice program at CU handle these cases? And I just kind of laughed and said, well, because number one, we only have about three facilitators. Number two, we don't have an office. We don't have a phone. We don't have a program, and the program's probably not going to be around. So she said, well, can you write a proposal to grow the program? And I said, sure. And so so I created sort of a new model of restorative discipline or justice that would enable us to process, you know, a lot more cases per year. And then I created a financial or a self-sustainability model so that the university wouldn't have to be paying for it, because the fees that the students are paying to the court system would instead go to our program as the students came through it. And so so I wrote the proposal, gave it to the judge, they accepted it, and then it became a question of selling the university on this program. The initial resistance was, well, we're not responsible for what students do in the communities around the campus, right, because they're off campus. But you know, but we explained, well, look, you're a member of the community, and these are your community members, and so they wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the university. So I asked the university for $50,000 budget, and I said, we'll pay you back at the end of the first year with the fees, and we did. But after the second year of doing this program, I trained 30 facilitators, some of them from the law school, some from the community, and students. And when I left, we were processing right around 400 cases per year.
And it's still running.
Yeah, it's still running. It became kind of a model for other universities. It's a huge success.
So we're doing a series of conversations about trust. And you've been on this trail for 18 years. What were you trusting when you did that, when you created that program for Boulder?
That's a good question. I think even more than trust, it was having the experience of what restoration can accomplish in terms of human relationships and repairing ruptures in right relationship, repairing harms, and giving people a second chance and providing healing for the victim. You know, one question that victims want that can really plague them is, why did you do this?
Sure.
Why did you do this to me? And, you know, to sit across from the person who committed the harm and say, look, this is how you impacted me, and why did you do it? There is a kind of emotional detachment and psychological detachment that happens in that discussion that liberates the victim from, you know, sort of the shackles of the event. And
the confusion
and the fear and the anxiety. And at the same time, the offender gets to see the real impact of their actions. And you know, in my experience, when offenders see that and hear that, there is the change mechanism for offenders is remorse, and hopefully empathy. And then you give them a way to essentially redeem themselves by repairing the harm and being forgiven.
What's most trustworthy in the restorative process?
Well, first of all, it's very structured.
It's predictable.
The process itself is very, very simple and very straightforward. It's pragmatic.
So people can experience it and then trust that this is a pattern that I'm going to go to again.
Yes, they come to rely upon it. And you know, when an incident happens, then we're kind of thrown into chaos, right? We don't know how to think about it. We don't know how to move through it. This is a very structured way of moving through a conflict or an act of misconduct or a violation. But to go back to trust, you know, I think after facilitating so many conferences before I even started the CU program or developed the CU program, I experienced the resolution that happened in these discussions. And it was that experience was provided for because of this process. And so when I realized, you know, because I did a deep dive into Navajo peacemaking, which are really the philosophical and practical roots of restorative justice, and, you know, discovered that this practice was around thousands of years before Christ. And, well, why? You know, it's an ancient wisdom and way that still works. It's almost timeless. And so in having that experience, facilitating these conferences and observing and witnessing the healing that was happening, you know, I became an advocate. I devoted my life to it because the trust is about, you know, having done probably, well, over 1,000 of these things, seeing what can happen, what does happen.
And indigenous people who have been doing it for thousands of years have grown up trusting it.
Oh yeah. Well, it's who they are.
And they have confidence in themselves and in each other.
Yeah. And I think it's ironic that, you know, here we are as Westerners and, you know, and certainly in my family, the Spanish, you know, we committed all these injustices against Native American people. And then here we are in, you know, 19, well, even today, asking them to teach us about justice, especially when our Western criminal justice methods have really marginalized them.
Right. So now you're doing a lot of work with schools.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the necessary components you take into a school?
Well, first of all, I guess the question is why schools? And, you know, this way of being in relationship with each other when we have conflict or misconduct or even when we experience traumatic incidents. You know, if we're ever going to get through this mess that we're seem to be mired in, you know, this moment with what's going on in Washington and the world, and then what is our surest guarantee of correcting that and transforming that and moving forward so it doesn't happen again, to go back to Santayana's quote? And it the future lies with our children. And that means that our schools and our families should be, you know, gifted with the opportunity to learn how to move through conflict and disagreements using the restorative process, the restorative method. And so I realized that, you know, for this ancient process to be rediscovered and reactivated again and accomplish what it can in terms of cultural and social change, then families need to have it, and schools need to have it so that children can learn the process and can come to appreciate the value of empathy and connectedness and accountability. You know, accountability, but in a non-punitive way. And so that's why I really focused on schools.
So the integrity of the person teaching this process is huge. What keeps it from being perverted by personal agendas?
Well, that's a damn good question. In my experience, restorative justice, as it's practiced in the criminal justice system, a lot of times the facilitators are volunteers. And it's been my experience that often people want to get involved in restorative justice, want to facilitate conferences because they have some part of themselves that needs to be restored. And so they carry these unresolved issues. You know, maybe it's, I don't know, some type of childhood abuse or something, but they want what restoration delivers, and so they get involved in it. But oftentimes that agenda that they have is unrecognized by them, and so they carry it into the circles.
So they're not going in clean.
They're not going in clean. And, you know, the Navajo people in their peacemaking courts warned us against this.
Because they've seen it.
Because they've seen it. And so what happens, unfortunately, to the practice is that because you're dealing with such sensitive issues,
sure,
you can not only not accomplish what it's supposed to accomplish, but you can re-victimize people because they're exposing their hurts. And so you really do have to be, you have to know what you're doing, but... And yet, ironically, children get it immediately.
You're listening to Shifting Gears and a conversation with Dr. Will Bledsoe about a restorative way. You explained to me when we talked earlier that restoration is about relationship.
Yes, restoration is about restoring relationships. The Navajo would probably say, and this is now used throughout the discourse of restorative practices, but it's restoration is returning people to right relationship. So to give you an example, if there's a conflict between two people, I'm doing a project now at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs, and so some of the organizational dynamics that exist, there's an entrenched pattern of conflict and lack of resolution. So over time, that unresolved conflict leads to further and further polarization of people, right? And so they are out of right relationship with themselves, and right relationship there would be the ability to come together and talk about important issues and make important decisions and collegiality and workplace harmony and ethical treatment of each other. And so they're out of right relationship. And so the restorative process is designed to talk about those, what happened, what is happening, why it's happening, how it's impacting everybody, and then create an agreement for how to repair those historical harms, bring everything out into the open, and then, more importantly, set some guidelines in place, a plan of action in place for making sure that it doesn't happen again. Positive action items for the agreement.
What's the relationship between commerce and restoration?
Well, as a facilitator, you don't get paid much. No. Can you help me a little further with that? What do you mean?
What happens when commerce takes priority over restoration?
I would say that that money then is getting in the way of being in right relationship with each other. You know, so commerce can either facilitate right relationship or break right relationship.
Right, I would think so.
Yeah, and so...
And there could be some resistance. There's a famous quote, it's difficult to have someone understand what you're saying to them when their paycheck depends on their not understanding it.
Right. What's that John Prine verse from his song, I'm okay and you're okay if the check's okay? You remember that?
Tell us about some of your experience with environmental issues.
Well, that's an interesting question. 2009, I was, I'm sort of an old environmental rebel, I guess, activist. You're reading people like John Muir and Stegner and, of course, Edward Abbey. And I'm an advocate for, you know, treating the environment as one of us. So I wanted to take this thing called restorative justice, right, that I'd been working in for 10 years, 9 years. And so what does it have to say about the environment? What does it have to say about environmental justice? So I started working with a guy, and his name is John Tucci in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And he walked out of his lake house one day and saw the lake covered with weeds and milfoil and algae. And he started on a mission to clean his own lake up, and thus began his journey in lake restoration. And his approach was to find a way to restore the lake's inherent capacity to continuously restore itself. And that means that he is restoring lakes at the microbiological level. So if you want to restore a lake that has weeds and algae, you don't throw aquacides on the lake. You don't poison the lake, because those weeds will fall to the bottom and start the next round of nutrification. So anyway, I started working with him and exploring his technology, and this goal that he had of restoring the ecosystem's capacity to process nutrients coming into it from the watershed. And very simple solution, and that is getting the lake to turn over. In other words, to bring dissolved oxygen down to the sedimentary level and increase aerobic bacteria. Very simple solution, and so elegantly restorative. And so working with him and doing his writing for him and taking his research reports, because I'm kind of a closet biologist, taking that and reading into it taught me a lot about restoration and also with people and communities. And so what you want to do ultimately in any restorative site, whether it's the environment or it's a community or it's a school or it's a family, you want to restore that organism's capacity and ability to continuously restore itself. And to me, that's the definition of resilience. That's the definition of sustainability. So I'm not going to go in and fix the problem. I'm going to come in and we're going to talk about the problem. And in the process of talking about what's going on, talk about the problem, you're going to learn how to restore the problem yourself. And, you know, that's what's great about organizations, workplaces, schools, families, collectives. You don't just give them fish. You teach them how to fish.
And you then made a transition from in this process from restorative justice to the restorative way.
Yeah.
Talk about that transition and what that means to have taken on. That's a bold move to take on restorative way.
Well, it was sometimes I question whether it was the right move. 2002, I started Restorative Way. And, you know, Navajo people call their restorative ceremonies, rituals, ways.
And the backbone of their medical system is the blessing way.
Exactly. And that is the primary ceremony out of which Navajo peacemaking and restorative peacemaking and restorative justice comes out of. But you see, in the Western world and in criminal justice, the thing that's missing, there's two components that are missing. Number one, restorative justice as it's practiced in the Western world does not take into consideration a person's spirit. So when you repair from a violation, you're looking at physical, material, you know, and emotional and maybe even psychological, but not the spiritual component. But Navajo restoration is deeply, it's a sacred ceremony. And so there's a whole much, much deeper level at stake in restoration as it is conducted in these ceremonial settings. And so I knew that because I taught Native American religious traditions at CU. I was a TA when I was working on the master's. And because I grew up, you know, in New Mexico and was familiar with Pueblo and Navajo ways, I knew that there was a depth of restoration that they were accessing that that Western restorative justice and criminal justice wasn't able to access. And so when I started the Restorative Way, the mission was to advance, extend, or expand restorative ways of communicating, language and engagement and interaction, and ways that would activate empathy and compassion and forgiveness and understanding and acknowledgement to get at the deeper level, the root causes of violations. So, you know, so the Restorative Way is a way of being in relationship with each other as we experience disagreement, conflict, violation, harmful behavior. And when you look at it from that perspective, it extends across the whole range of human behavior, both historical and current.
Thank you, Dr. Bledsoe.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Shifting Gears and a conversation with Dr. Will Bledsoe about a restorative way. This is KDNK. A second conversation on the restorative way will be broadcast in 2 days on Wednesday at 4:30. Thank you for listening.